Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Daniel Philpott, a full professor of political science and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame, who focuses on the intersection of religion and politics worldwide. He is the author and/or editor of several important books, including Revolutions and Sovereignty, How Ideas Shape Modern International Relations, Just and Unjust Peace, An Ethic of Political Conciliation, The Politics of Past Evil, Religion, Reconciliation, and Transnational Justice, and God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics, co-authored with Monica Toft and Timothy Shaw. We had a series of three podcasts discussing that latter book with each of the authors, and you can find those discussions in our archives and linked on our webpage. And not being satisfied with just writing four books, Dan is now in the midst of working on another one, tentatively entitled Religious Freedom in Islam. I should note that when we last talked with Dan directly on our show back in 2011, he was merely an associate professor, which just goes to show you that promotions and other good things do happen when you appear on Research on Religion. We're very effective that way. Need a promotion? Give us a call. Dan has also been an indirect guest on our podcast as well, being featured on panel discussions sponsored by the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center, where he is an affiliated researcher on a project examining the relationship between religious liberty and social flourishing. As full disclosure, I am also a member of that project. Dan has published and continues to publish numerous articles in various top-shelf academic journals, including the American Political Science Review, World Politics, and the Journal of Democracy, as well as editing the blog Arc of the Universe and serving as the director, currently on leave, of the Center for Civil and Human Rights at Notre Dame. We will link to all of these books, podcasts, centers, and his blog for your convenience over at our website, so please make sure that you check that out. Dan, welcome back to Research on Religion, and a belated two-year congratulation on promotion to full professor.
Thank you, Tony. Wonderful to be here, and if it has the kind of benefits that you're saying it will, I can't wait to see what my next opportunity or break will be from appearing on this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's just basically one simple step to being the president of Notre Dame, or more importantly, the head football coach.
So. Well, I'd make a lot more money if I were the head football coach, as we all know.
That is true. But we would miss you in political science because you are an important author who has been writing a lot of very interesting things here, including not just stuff for scholars, but you write for a general public audience, and you have a blog called Arc of the Universe. And I want to talk a little bit about that here at first, because some of the things that we will be discussing today have been drawn from that material that you've posted over there. And just looking at the title, Arc of the Universe, I'm assuming it's all about cosmology and where stars and planets and stuff come from. So that seems a little odd for a political science to be writing about. So please explain what this universe and arc is all about.
The phrase comes from Martin Luther King, who said that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So the blog is really about global justice, most centrally. But like Martin Luther King, it looks at justice in a way that is strongly informed by religion. And so the standing bloggers who are committed to writing regular posts are mostly people who look at global justice issues somehow through a religious lens. So something like religious freedom is really front and center.
Yeah, and it's a nice blog because it's not overwhelmed by lots of stuff. You write very in-depth, thoughtful pieces on a regular basis, and it's a good thing that people should go and check out there. Who, other than you, and you write quite a bit on there, who else is involved in the Arc of the Universe?
Regular contributors are Jennifer Bryson, who's down at the Zephyr Institute in the Bay Area, and she does a lot of innovative work on Islam and religious freedom in Islam. There's Marianne Cusimano-Love, who writes a lot in the Catholic context on global justice issues. There's Rob Joustra, a Reformed Protestant Christian who is Canadian and writes also very widely on justice issues. And they're probably the most regular.
Now, you mentioned that religious liberty is one of the themes that comes up. Are there any other themes that pop up regularly on that blog?
Well, anything dealing with global justice. So you have issues of war and peace, nuclear ethics, anything that Pope Francis says, pretty wide variety of justice issues.
Okay. Well, the topic that I want to focus on today is one that we cover frequently here on our podcast, and that's the issue of religious freedom. That's an issue that I study and research and is one near and dear to my heart. The angle that we're going to approach this topic today, though, is going to relate to the heavy fire that this seemingly innocuous concept of religious liberty or religious freedom has taken from critics recently. So give us some sense of where these criticisms have originated from and what are the grounds they are making for criticizing the promotion of religious liberty here at home and abroad.
Well, perhaps we can start with the rise of religious freedom as a major issue. I think the group of critics who has arisen really arises in response to this becoming a major issue. In the late 90s, a bunch of activists for human rights started noticing that a lot of the human rights victims in the world were victims of religious persecution. That led to the passage of the International Religious Freedom Act by the U.S. Congress, mandating religious freedom in U.S. foreign policy. And it has been, put into U.S. foreign policy ever since then. Interestingly, a number of Western governments, Canada, Italy, Germany, several Western European countries, only in the last 3 or 4 years are adopting religious freedom into their foreign policies in one way or another, even the European Union. Okay? Now, add to that the fact that religious freedom has become an issue in the United States more and more, in response to issues of kind of the boundaries between government and religion, really in the last 10 years or so, relating to the HHS mandate and that sort of thing. So you see religious freedom in the conversation much more than it ever has been. And I think that's the context in which these critics are saying, hey, we've got some issues with this.
Now, one of the things that you do is focus on global politics, and you've been working in Africa recently, but you have a great deal of familiarity with Europe and many other parts of the world. You're a very broad empirical base for a scholar. In terms of Europe and Canada adopting or getting on the bandwagon of religious freedom and injecting that into their foreign policy, why are they doing that now? What took them so long? Why not back in the 90s with the United States?
What took them so long is a good question. I'm not sure the answer to it. I do think it involves following the United States lead from the International Religious Freedom Act and following in that trajectory. But also, the number of religious freedom violations in the world has risen quite significantly in the last 15, 20 years. And most recently, just grabbing the headlines are the brutalities inflicted by the Islamic State. And I think that has a lot to do with why maybe now. It's certain salient episodes are really putting it on the, in the middle of the political discussion.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of injecting religious liberty into the foreign policy realm here in the United States, is this Are those efforts specifically targeting one region, for instance, the Middle East, or is this a global policy? Does it affect Africa, Latin America, China, et cetera?
No, I think it really is global. It was, and it's mandated to be so. At first, the first effort, round of efforts to get the legislation passed, it was kind of spearheaded by Protestant evangelicals, and it was seen as a kind of Christian-based kind of movement. And then that version voted down, but then the version that passed in part because it was construed as a much broader movement dealing with every region of the world, every religion, and that's mandated into the annual report that the State Department produces on international religious freedom, which is required to cover every country in the world. So all of our embassies are reporting back every year the religious freedom situation there. And it's actually a remarkably even-handed, careful, professional report, which is a fantastic resource for scholars and activists, precisely because it is truly global in scope. And whether it's Baha'is in Iran or Muslims in Gujarat, India, or Christians or Uyghur Muslims in China or what have you, it covers everyone.
Mm-hmm. It is a great resource for scholars. We've had Jonathan Fox on the podcast before, who has built a huge index around a lot of the measurements that have gone on in that. And so we are getting a better sense of where some of these violations exist and how they've changed over time. Okay, so this all seems fairly innocuous. I mean, promoting religious liberty seems like kind of a good thing, but there have been some critics of this approach, and specifically of injecting it into foreign policy. What's the main basis for this critique?
Well, there seems to be a kind of school of thought, and in this book I'm writing, I call them the new critics, because they share a remarkably admirably coherent set of assumptions. I mean, one almost wants to call them a well-organized conspiracy, but I say that jealously rather than derisively. I mean, they're kind of a great example of an academic, well-organized academic project where they are really putting together a common set of criticisms. So there's this group. Their thought initially appeared on a website called the Imminent Frame, and you know they have a combination of looks at both the United States, examinations of the United States, as well as religious freedom policy, as well as a religious freedom situation around the world, and they come off quite critical of really of efforts by Westerners to promote religious freedom around the world.
And what would be the basis? I mean, if they had to have maybe one critique, is there multiple prong critiques? What?
I think it's pretty easy to summarize. Their view is that religious freedom is really not a universal human value. That's really a Western value that comes out of the kind of unique historical trajectory of the West. And so that's already a problem. The West is imposing something that's theirs on others in ways that they think it makes very little sense in the context of the Islamic world or many, many places outside of our boundaries. But then I would say marry that thought that it's Western with a different thought, which is that it's the product of power. So they see the West as, in terms of its colonialist history and then the kind of American imperialism of the Cold War and post-Cold War period. And so they say that this is a Western value, but that's imposed by Western power and with all sorts of pernicious and bad effects.
In terms of that critique, I mean, we're talking about that religious freedom is not a universal value. How would you respond to that?
Well, I fundamentally differ in the sense that I think that the International Human Rights Conventions have it correct, that religious freedom is, in fact, a universal human right, not just in the sense that it's been declared a universal human right by most countries of the world, but also I think it can be defended according to human nature, that this is something that is, manifests human dignity per se. for, you know, being a human being gives you a strong interest in asking and exploring and the most ultimate questions and living out answers to those questions. And by and large, people ought to be free to do that. So when we see something like there was a New York Times report over the summer about the Islamic State seizing Yazidi girls and making them into, you know, sex slaves and raping them and so forth, but then seizing them because of their religious beliefs. They seize the Yazidis in a way that they're not seizing, you know, the people next door, the Christians or what have you, or in the same way, because they think that the Yazidis have a particularly problematic theology, and the theology of the Islamic State informs what they're doing to the Yazidis. Well, it seems to me that that's, you know, nobody should have that done to them on the basis of their religious beliefs. And it seems to me that's something universally, no matter what your culture, no matter where you come from, you could say that that's something wrong, that that's, there's something inviolable there about a person and the person, the relationship of their dignity to their religious quest that, you know, just can't be violated.
And when you read articles like that in the New York Times, or you see reports of this on the news, and sometimes it comes with very graphic pictures that really burn in your conscience, one would think, well, you know, I guess promoting this religious liberty wouldn't be that bad of a thing. How would the critics respond to, you know, something like the Yazidis saying, hey, this is not really good for these people. Maybe the United States should speak out about this, or maybe Europe should.
Yeah. Right. Well, they usually, what they do is tend to complexify. They would say, they probably wouldn't deny what's happening to the Yazidis, but they would say that's just one of many, many different things across the board. There are many reasons for the conflict surrounding ISIS and in the Middle East. They would probably point to the role of the U.S. in helping to foment the conflict because of various, you know, aspects of U.S. foreign policy and so forth. And they would say that just kind of seizing upon religion and making it to be the central thing is highly distorting.
One of the interesting things about the critiques of religious liberty is that you would normally think this would come from people who are not on board with religion and, you know, people who you might consider to be secularist. And you wrote in a paper at the American Political Science Association conference back in 2014 that many of these critics are also critical of secularism. And that at first appears odd, given that we are usually used to seeing atheists challenge the rights of religious groups. But they have an interesting critique of secularism as well, and that plays into their conceptions of religious liberty. Explain that a little bit, if you can.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. You might think at first that these would be kind of hardened secularists who are worried about, you know, the influence of religion on things. But one of the godfathers of the kind of whole group of these new critics is a prominent anthropologist named Talal Asad. And Talal Asad argues that in the kind of Western Enlightenment period, in the kind of secularizing movement, religion ended up being kind of squeezed out or marginalized, and that there's kind of a dominance of secularism in the world that doesn't make much room for religion. And so part of what these scholars like Asad want to do is to say, hey, let's, you know, these exclusive moves against religion that come from a dominant secular worldview are problematic. We need to recognize that a lot of the world has some religious beliefs, and our Western secularism isn't everything and isn't as universal as we think it is. Well, that's all well and good. I'm by and large, I'm pretty sympathetic to that. Now, how does that get us to their views of religious freedom? Well, they think that religious freedom as a value is actually bound up in the kind of Western secularism of the Enlightenment, that religious freedom is something that emerges out of a kind of secular worldview. Whereas, you know, we have to remember other cultures understand religion in a way that doesn't, you know, value or put such central status on religious freedom. So what they would say then is that when the West goes around the world imposing religious freedom and putting pressure on countries to be more religiously free, it's really a part of that kind of project in which the West is imposing its own forms against parts of the world that are religious and that understand their religion in different ways. So let's stop imposing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting critique. So let's go ahead and talk about what you also do in your 2014 APSA paper.
Yes.
And that is critique the critiques. Why do you think some of these critiques are wrong? Now, we kind of discussed it in general. We talked about the issue of universal principles or not. But here's your opportunity to say, how would you defend the case for religious freedom, and more specifically, defend the case for promoting religious freedom globally?
Yeah, good. Well, at the heart of my argument, once again, is that religious freedom is a dimension of human dignity, that the human person has an interest in the most ultimate questions and embracing answers to them that we call religion. And that is part of the human quest for the good, for truth, and that should not be interfered with. Now, having said that, that's kind of my core argument. I actually want to raise questions about this kind of sense in which these scholars say that religious freedom is a Western thing, whereas it's not so prevalent among the rest of the world. And I want to argue two things. First of all, that it's really not as Western as they think it is. And then second, that the, quote, rest of the world, if you can generalize about such a thing, actually, there's actually a lot more religious freedom and support for religious freedom than their critiques suggest. So they're actually falling into a kind of binary, simplistic view of the world and seeing it as the West versus the rest and putting religious freedom on the West and not religious freedom on the rest. Mm-hmm. I can elaborate on that if you want, but...
Yeah, go ahead, and let's dive into that a little bit more. I'm interested in what you have to say here, but one of the first things that I have to ask is this question of a right. When we talk about the promotion of religious liberty, it's oftentimes promoted as a right. And what do you mean by a right?
Sure. Well, right is essentially a kind of, an immunity that every person and religious community has from being coerced in the basic practice and expression of their religion. So it just says, hey, look, there's some things that can't be interfered with, and everybody has a just claim, not to be interfered with. And the wisdom among these kind of critics is that this idea emerges in the Western Enlightenment in the 18th century and then becomes part of a kind of colonial imperialism project. Well, it's not true. There were actually, the idea that there's a right of religious freedom that comes with human dignity is stated very strongly by some of the early Christian thinkers in the 3rd and 4th century, people like Tertullian and Lactantius. In fact, Tertullian actually uses the phrase humana juris. There's a human right, and he's talking about the human right to religious freedom. Well, that's remarkable. This comes, 1,500 years before the Enlightenment. And they're essentially defending what the modern human rights documents say, that there's a, right not to be interfered with based upon human dignity and the importance of religion. Mm-hmm. One other thing, so the same critic says, well, this is something foreign to Islam. They don't think of the human right of religious freedom. Well, in the Quran, you actually have a verse that is one of the most direct statements of something like religious freedom that you'll see in the holy writings and books of any religion. Quran 2:256 says, there is no compulsion in religion. You can't compel religion. People have a right not to be compelled in this. I mean, it's just a short step away from saying people have a right not to be compelled in this.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, throughout the Islamic tradition, jurists have always read this verse in that very light. And so this notion of a right, I want to kind of deconstruct their deconstruction by saying this is not just a modern Enlightenment thing.
Mm-hmm. You also say that it not only goes back in history and not only crosses a few different faiths in terms of the support for religious liberty, but that there's a lot of support for this around the world. Explain that.
Well, what I would say is that rather than a West versus the rest dynamic, we should say that there is a kind of set of pro-religious freedom forces and a set of anti-religious freedom forces in virtually any region or religion. For instance, in Islam, you can find a kind of strain of jurists throughout the history interpreting there is no compulsion in religion as saying, you can't forcibly convert people and you've got to allow minorities to practice their religion and so forth. And even today, there's kind of a fairly robust religious freedom constituency in Islam. It's kind of I would say it's still a minority, to be sure, admittedly, but it is there. And most religions have a kind of faction of people, speaking for religious freedom. In the same way, in the West, which is thought to be the kind of place where religious freedom dominates, in this idea, according to these critics, one can find a lot of anti-religious freedom vectors. Look at the first half of the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. Okay, well, look, we have the greatest movement to brutalize religion in human history in the Nazis. We have maybe the second greatest in Soviet Russia. We've got anti-clerical movements in France and Italy and Mexico. And, this is the place, the West is where religious freedom dominates. Okay. This was only, 70, 80 years ago that it looked like things were going much more against religious freedom than they were for religious freedom. So even in the West, which is supposedly, the religious freedom place, religious freedom has been very, very fragile and very contested.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that comes up in the critiques oftentimes is the definition of religion, because, again, that might be a Western construct here, what religion means, and that there's really a lot of different conceptions of what religion is and how it can be construed. And so I think a lot of this issue revolves around the definition of what religion is. And I think one of the critiques that is out there is that, well, when Western nations like the United States or Europe come to talk about religious freedom, they have specific definitions of religion in mind that tend to bias legal structures in favor of, let's say, Christianity or certain flavors of Christianity. What say you on that?
Right. Well, that's another thing that is another one of their key contentions of this group, is that they don't like universals. A lot of them are influenced by postmodern ideas, and so the key there is that there are no universals. And so they think that efforts to talk about religion in some universal sense are misbegotten and kind of reflects a broader view in academia, which is that there just is no definition of religion. And I would take issue. And there's a wonderful book by a scholar at University of Chicago by a fellow named anthropologist named Martin Riesebrot, arguing for what is kind of arguably a kind of common sense definition of religion. By common sense, I don't mean that people who don't agree with it are stupid or lack common sense in the way that we talk about that. Only that there's kind of a readily apprehensible sense of what a religion is that really isn't so hard to recognize. So, I'm a Westerner, but when I go over to India and walk down the street, and there's a building that looks an awful lot like a temple, and there's a bunch of people out there with candles and chanting, and they're inside it looks like they're doing something a lot like praying, and they're somehow supplicating some superhuman powers. Well, that looks an awful lot like religion, Same thing if I walk down the street in Jakarta or Bangkok, I'm going to see the same kind of phenomenon. And I think that there is a kind of, universally recognizable thing called religion. It may not be possible to define precisely, but that is human, and that you find it over an enormous variety of times and places. I mean, National Geographic published this story about they were finding a temple in Turkey in something like 12,000 BC that really showed that this prehistoric civilization was worshiping before they were doing agriculture and other things like that. So it seems to me there is something kind of universally recognizable that's called religion, that is a kind of human impulse to acknowledge and worship superhuman powers who take an interest in the most important questions that they ask, and who, in a sense, embody answers to the most, you know, ultimate questions that people ask. And this activity of worshiping and organizing one's life around those superhuman powers seems to be something remarkably, remarkably common, remarkably human, I would say, in the end.
One of the things that I've thought about in terms of the promotion of religious freedom and whether or not it's promoting a specific flavor of religion is really the fact that freedom benefits the ability for religion to change. And we've seen that within the Christian tradition, that whole thing called the Reformation, where you get a breakaway from the Catholic Church, and then it becomes very vociferous from then on, that people are creating new innovations, new ways to do things, possibly revising doctrines. And this is not only true in Christianity, but in many other faith traditions as well. I think you see it in Judaism, you see it in Islam, you see it in Hinduism. And that freedom, or that religious freedom, is very important for basically allowing people to self-define religion. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, again, one of the ideas from these critics is that what the U.S. and West is trying to impose around the world is really kind of a Protestant understanding of religion that is largely based upon, makes religion really a matter of abstract ideas. And it goes back to the Reformation, which was kind of trying to clean up some of the what they thought were excessive practices and sometimes superstitions in the Catholic Church, and they saw it as overly ritualized. So they were trying to kind of recover the idea of a belief of the heart and a belief that is enacted in experience in life as opposed to all these rituals. And so, you know, there is something to the idea that Protestantism was about that. And these critics are saying that the human right to religious freedom that the West is trying to impose around the world is really this kind of Protestantized understanding, and that, you know, is not consonant and resonant with the experiences of people elsewhere who have much more ritualized understandings of religion, much more of a practice-based understanding of religion, an understanding of religion that is not so organized around doctrines and propositions and so forth. But again, I would have to sharply disagree. I think that if you look at the Human Rights Conventions, if you look at the 1981 Declaration on the elimination of all forms. By the way, the title to that document has about 15 words. I can never remember it. Basically, eliminating discrimination. And the ways in which it protects religion are so broad and manifest. It protects not only individuals, but it protects communities. By the way, that's another of their critiques, which is that the Protestant is a very individualistic understanding, that that's what's being promoted. But no, the human rights documents protect individuals, they protect communities, they protect rights, they protect beliefs, they protect really the whole range of religious experience. And so, it's something that Buddhists have an interest in, that Hindus have an interest in, that, virtually everybody who practices a religious faith has an interest in, you know, can be protected by these human rights norms. I don't think it just protects a kind of Protestantized version of religion. And by the way, I'm not even sure that's fair to Protestantism in the end either.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, Protestants practice rituals. They go to church on Sunday. Often they have very strong communities. They have communion. They have, the idea that they're just kind of living it in their heads is, not fair to the kind of live reality of Protestant worship and practice, I think.
And let me, ask in terms of the empirical reality of this. You examine this quite a bit, and we have the, for the past decade and a half, the religious freedom requirements within U.S. foreign policy. Has there been an effort to promote just the Protestant flavor of religious liberty, or have these efforts of promoting religious liberty worldwide benefited non-Protestant communities as well?
Well, again, the U.S. report, just look at the report that comes out every year. I mean, it's defending Baha'is and Hindus and Rohingya Muslims, and it's the wide range of people in China. I mean, part of the mandate of the report is to cover every religion. And So, you know, it really goes out of its way not just to be Protestant. Again, there was some legitimate concern to some degree at the beginning that the way the legislation was being crafted, it looked a little bit like it was kind of trying to protect evangelical missionaries and so forth. But the way that it ended up and the way that it was cashed out, you know, it truly is very beautifully universal.
And you mentioned a couple international documents that reflect the claim for a universal right to religious freedom, and a number of countries have signed on to this, correct?
Oh yes. I mean, if you look at the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is the main legal instrument for political and civil human rights, and its Article 18 protects religious freedom. You know, 39 out of 47 Muslim majority states have signed on to that. Only 6 have abstained, and one other one, I think, has signed but not ratified. So it's got a very large number of the world states have signed on, and so it does have a lot of buy-in. Now, you know, I think it is important to realize there is some movement afoot in the Muslim world to kind of mitigate that. They've come up with a universal Islamic Declaration of Human Rights and then something called the Cairo Declaration of 1990 on human rights, which are actually pretty weak on religious freedom, unfortunately kind of offset that progress. But on the positive side, we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN Covenant, we've got the 1981 Declaration, whose name we would take the rest of the session trying to pronounce, and but it's a wonderful document. So there are some international documents that do have very, very wide buy-in.
Now, one of the other critiques that have come up, and especially here at home recently, is that religious liberty is often used to stomp on other freedoms. And that critique comes up internationally as well, is that, well, you know, you're promoting religious freedom might interfere with freedom that other groups might have to do what they wish. How, kind of explain what that critique is about and how you would answer that.
Well, you always have to ask, what are the other rights that are being asserted that, you know, are offsetting or competing with or being smothered by religious freedom? So, I mean, religious freedom has a place in the Universal Documents. It has a key place in the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, if people feel threatened by that in some way, they often come up with some competing right, which they say is, you know, being smothered by it. So, you know, I'm here at the University of Notre Dame, for instance, where it's interesting because we're a Catholic university. We try to govern our policies in accordance with the teachings of the Catholic Church. And there's been some conflict in recent years by things like the Health and Human Services mandate, which is kind of, you know, mandating for us to provide contraceptions and abortifacient drugs and so forth in our health care plans. Well, some people are saying, you know, there are some people even at Notre Dame who are saying, well, we have a right to have the government fund, you know, these things, our contraception, our, you know, certain drugs and so forth and so on. But that strikes me as dubious. I mean, again, religious freedom is part of the First Amendment to the Constitution. There's nothing in the First Amendment called a right to have the government fund your contraception. I mean, regardless of what you think about contraception or whether, you know, people should use it, but to say that there's a right that the government will fund my, you know, purchase of this just seems to be, yeah, there's very little history or track record behind that. Mm-hmm. And so I would put a pretty strong presumption in favor of religious freedom. Now, having said that, religious freedom is not absolute. And, you know, there are some things that you can't do in the name of your religion. In the United States, we have decided that polygamy is not permitted, even though it might be sanctioned by a religion. I mean, obviously there are things like child sacrifice or whatever, you know, when it starts to violate other fundamental human rights, then we've got a problem. So religious freedom is not absolute, but I would be one who would argue for making it as wide as possible.
Now, one of the things that you say in your 2014 APSA paper that I thought was very interesting was that moral relativism does not flow from empirical diversity. And this cuts across this issue that we're talking about here. Explain that to me.
Yes. Well, I mean, one of the things that these critics say is they try to take the Westerners to task for saying that religious freedom is universal. And essentially their argument is you haven't traveled enough. You know, you probably come from some small town in the U.S. where they like religious freedom, and now you naively are part of a U.S. foreign policy effort to promote it everywhere. But if you just traveled to places like Pakistan and India and Burma and China and so forth, you would see that, you know, many people think about things in many very, very different ways. There are many ways to skin a cat. Some people, religious freedom is for some cultures, it's not for others. And then from that, you know, recognition of diversity, you would then back off your claim that there is a universal human right to religious freedom. Well, it seems to me that's a non sequitur. I mean, the fact that there is diversity on something around the world doesn't mean that it doesn't follow that, you know, that we should be adopt moral relativism. And I would just kind of let's shift the issue. Let's imagine that it's torture. Well, there are many different views of whether torture is justified around the world. You can find great empirical diversity. They are culturally informed. They are torture is also part of the universal human rights conventions. The U.S. has been known to try to promote, you know, the right not to be tortured, although maybe we have our own issues at times to deal with. But in other words, you could say all the same things about torture that they say about religious freedom. Yet I would ask, who of them would not want to affirm a human right against torture? I mean, most of the people of their kind of mindset were extremely critical of the administration of George W. Bush when it practiced torture or something that was allegedly torture. And I tend to agree with the criticism. But I would only ask, well, you know, if you say that about torture, to which all the same, you know, conditions of diversity apply, then why do you single religious freedom out for this criticism of being imperialistic?
One of the other critiques that comes up too is that religious freedom, as it's implemented in the State Department and through the reports, also links it to issues of trade relations, and that religious freedom really isn't about a concern for people abroad, but it's really a leveraging point to expand the power of the United States. To what extent do you think that is true?
Well, in my view, this is greatly exaggerated. You know, most people who are advocates of religious freedom policy are usually lamenting that the policy is so marginal, it's seconded off to a corner of the State Department. It tends not to be integrated into mainstream foreign policy. Even as a kind of a test, look at the administration of George W. Bush, which ideologically would probably be much more sympathetic to religious freedom than either his predecessor, Clinton, or his successor, Obama. And yet even there was, under President Bush, there was very little effort to kind of promote religious freedom. Even in two cases where the U.S. had the power of military occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, the constitutions in both countries ended up being very weak on religious freedom. And so here's even in the case where ideologically and power-wise we might have most promoted it, we didn't. And so the idea is that the U.S. is sort of using this as leverage for U.S. economic or military or other kinds of power strikes me as greatly exaggerated. And that's interesting because these critics are very much of the view that power is behind everything. But yet, when, you know, in the situation where religious freedom had the most potential power behind it, you know, it wasn't put forth.
That brings me to the topic of how it is being promoted. And you make a case that the defense of religious freedom is very important. It should be promoted around the world and possibly even here at home. But how do we go about doing that? I mean, and I share this perspective with you. I share this with the critics as well, that, you know, the top-down approach of appointing an ambassador to go to a different country and say, hey, religious liberty or else, is really, really ineffective.
Right.
If, right. From your vantage point, what has the United States been doing right? What have they been doing wrong?
Right.
How would you do it differently?
Yeah. Well, I actually agree with that to some extent. I mean, I'm not in total agreement with all aspects of our religious freedom policy. So unlike the critics, I think it's universal. I think it's a good thing to promote. I think people have an interest in it everywhere. It's a human right and all that. But, you know, there are some questions to be asked about whether having the ambassador kind of circulate around the world and lecturing governments, whether that's the best approach. And in fact, you know, after 17 years of this policy, I think it's fair to ask, you know, is there a country in the world that is any more religiously free than it otherwise would be because we send this ambassador around to lecture everyone? And I think the answer may well be no. So there must be a better approach. But rather than discard religious freedom policy, I would say let's put some different emphases. And the ones that I would say are mainstreaming, multilateralism, and transnationalism. So mainstreaming means religious freedom should not be seconded off to a corner of the State Department. It should be integrated into the high-level security policy and diplomacy and so forth. Multilateralism means we shouldn't just pursue it alone, but we should try to build as wide a coalition as possible among other Western powers, but also non-Western powers, in promoting religious freedom. And then third, transnationalism means that some of the most powerful advocates of religious freedom are already on the ground in these countries where we want it to be promoted. And if they can be supported, and if they can network with each other and help to build a kind of international religious freedom constituency, that could well be the most powerful thing, because they could have the best chance of kind of changing the hearts and minds and building cultures of religious freedom, you know, in countries where it's suppressed. I mean, a lot of the countries that have religious freedom policy, the problem is really, you know, very oppressive atmospheres where, you know, there's a dictatorship and it represses religion because religion is part of the opponent to the dictatorship. And, you know, the voices of religious freedom among the people are basically muffled. And if you can find ways to strengthen and support some of, you know, the kind of religious freedom dissidents or the religious freedom constituencies, ultimately, I think that could be a lot more powerful than, you know, going around the world just meeting with the top, you know, having those high-level meetings with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia or what have you.
Well, one of the things that you are doing with a number of your different academic projects is getting out there into the grassroots, and your field work is quite amazing. And so you get to see some of this right there where it impacts people the most, not in the high palaces of power, but right there in the, you know, local towns and communities that it makes a difference in people's lives. What role do you see of everyday people having an impact on promoting religious freedom, or instances of non-governmental organizations having an impact there?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think of somewhere like India, where right now there's a big problem because you have a lot of Hindu extremists, which are violating the religious freedom of Christians and Muslims. And you've got Indian government, which is kind of, or Hindu nationalist government in power, which is kind of providing sanction and often turning a blind eye to acts of brutality and so forth. However, there are also a lot of NGOs, parliamentarians, and other influential voices who are speaking for it, religious freedom, and speaking for the kind of tradition of religious freedom that India has in fact had. And you know, countering these, you know, domestic voices against religious freedom are voices for religious freedom. And I think a lot of times through transnational advocacy, they can be strengthened and kind of networked with people overseas who are also advocating for religious freedom and supporting them and so forth. And, you know, drawing upon India's traditions and its constitution, and you know, using that as a basis for promoting religious freedom against these also domestic efforts to shut it down.
Mm-hmm. You know, about a year or so ago, we had Rebecca Shaw come in and talk about what she is seeing at the grassroots in India and
right.
basically multi-faith yeah. communities where you do have Hindus and Muslims and Christians living side by side. And
right.
we'll link back to her podcast, but she has found that some of the greatest successes are not necessarily coming from the top down, but are really bubbling up from the bottom.
Yes, that's right. And oftentimes it's people on the ground and communities like that who sort of demonstrate how to live with a religious other in a way that is charitable and respectful.
Yeah.
And that could have a large demonstration effect. And not only the people who live in those communities, but the people who see them and notice them and want to imitate them. That can have a big effect.
Yeah, we'll link back to Rebecca's podcast for the folks who want to listen to it because, again, it's very heartening. And it also shows, it goes back to one of those earlier points that you were making, that there is a demand for religious liberty. When people are yeah. in close proximity to one another and they share different faiths, which could potentially lead to conflict, they oftentimes go, you know what? Religious liberty, religious toleration, that's kind of a good idea. Maybe we should promote that a little bit.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, oftentimes it's among religiously mixed populations, they come to realize, we've got to live with each other. And living with each other means allowing each other to practice our deepest faith. And I think ultimately, if you want to spread religious freedom, you've got to reach the hearts and minds. And I think the current ambassador of religious freedom, David Saperstein, gets this in a very, very beautiful way. And the importance of building coalitions, of building relationships, building transnational ties. It's more constructive and more building than it is this kind of going around and lecturing the guy at the top. And, of course, everybody leaves the meeting. Nothing happens. They're just telling the Americans what they want to hear. But if you really, kind of build the constituencies among people who really do want it, then, that demand ultimately is going to be heard by the state.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Speaking of lecturing, the one thing that I want to close off with here is the role of academics. We're good at lecturing. We're good at writing things. We're good at publishing books and publishing academic papers and talking on podcasts and things like that. And I've always wondered, to what extent do scholars have an impact on real life circumstances of individuals? And you've had the opportunity to not only think in a scholarly fashion, but to really in many ways promote the ideas that you are thinking about. To what extent do you think scholars have an impact on this broader debate, not only folks defending religious freedom, but folks who are a little bit more skeptical of it? Where do you see all this heading?
Well, I'm very much of the view that ideas matter, and for scholars to develop compelling arguments, makes it possible for those who want to, in the more activist realm, to, gives them arguments on the basis of which they can be convinced to promote this. And if we can show what the basis for religious freedom is morally and in terms of human nature, but also we can give empirical evidence that religious freedom is associated with lots of other good things like stability and democracy and economic growth, then, there's an actual case, there's actual evidence that those in the activist realm can use to make their arguments. One example of a realm in which academics really mattered is on the Catholic Church's road to embracing religious freedom, which it did in Dignitatis Humanae, its declaration in 1965. It was very important. The Catholic Church, has got 1 billion people in it. The fact that the leadership embraced religious freedom, helps to promote it among this very large constituency. Well, this was a big shift for the Catholic Church, because before it always wanted to say that in principle you could, you know, a state could use coercion to help to enforce the, you know, Catholic faith. Well, one of the real factors that laid the groundwork for Dignitatis Humanae was the work of intellectuals who convinced the top leadership of the church that they found a way for the church to embrace religious freedom in a way that was compatible with the ongoing theology of the church, and that it did not involve a contradiction in previous, you know, fundamental teachings of the church. So people like Jacques Maritain and John Courtney Murray and Heinrich Rahman and others really laid the intellectual groundwork and theological groundwork. If they had not done that, Dignitatis Humanae would not have been possible. Dignitatis Humanae, in turn, led to what I've called the Catholic Wave, where the Catholic Church around the world, because you've written on this too, became a force for democratization. And so ideas make a difference, and this is a case where they made a big difference.
And Dignitatis Humanae is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. In fact, I think it was just released in a month or so, 50 years ago. So
yes, December 7th. Yep. That's right.
So we'll have to have a show on that one, I think, at some point in time. But you've certainly given us a lot of food for thought on the topic of religious liberty. And I want to thank Dan Philpott for being on Research on Religion. Dan, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'm a big fan of the podcast. So all power to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.